Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The centuries-old art of salmon fishing fly tying has a dark side. It harkens back to a time when Europeans were first setting eyes on the exotic birds of the world. They quickly became obsessed with possessing them, with using their feathers and skins for fashion and for art, and with making as much money off the creatures as possible. Fast forward to 2009, when hundreds of scientific specimens are stolen from a suburban outpost of the British Museum of Natural History. The thief, a 20-year-old American flautist named Edwin Rist. He was also considered at the time to be the future of fly tying. Author Kirk Wallace Johnson heard about the heist when he was waist deep in a river fly fishing. The story of human obsession and incomplete justice launched him into an investigation of his own. His new book is called The Feather Thief, and he joins us now on the phone. Kirk Johnson, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we should say up front, you've got a little history in South Dakota. Tell me about that.
My dad was spent the better part of his childhood in Beresford, where my grandpa had a church there. So I've been hearing about the virtues of Beresford in South Dakota my whole life, and now he's horrified that I live in Los Angeles and not a good place like South Dakota.
All right, well, you better tell us your dad's name so everyone here can say, oh yeah, we know him.
Tom Johnson was his
name.
All
right, there you go. Let's talk about the book. And it begins with, I have a confession at first. I'm reading this book, and I start having dreams about exotic birds. Just from reading the book and the research that you did, it must have been for you, so much more intense to really follow this path for such a long time. And it goes back to a naturalist, Alfred Russel Wallace. He's a contemporary of Charles Darwin. Tell me about his contribution to science, especially in the way that he labeled his bird specimens.
Wallace is a really extraordinary person who's kind of famous for being not famous.
Right.
It's a remarkable moment in the history of science, but he spent 8 years going on a collecting expedition for specimens in the Malay archipelago in what's now Malaysia and Indonesia, partly because he was in pursuit of an answer to the burning question of the day, which is how are new species formed? Why do some species die off? Darwin hadn't published anything at that moment. And in the middle of a malarial fever, Wallace is sort of sweltering in his bed. He's wrapped in a blanket in 90-degree heat. And he has this breakthrough moment where he pieces together, bit by bit, a theory of evolution through natural selection. And he waits impatiently for the fever to break, and he sits down and he writes the first paper intended for publication on this. And the guy he mails it to is Charles Darwin. And Wallace, you know, he returns a couple of years later to London, and Darwin is famous the world over for this theory. I'm not suggesting Darwin stole it. It's just that he's given all of the glory for it.
Right.
But Wallace was also really, he's now hailed as the father of biogeography. So he recognized the importance of natural boundary lines, like deep water straits where one species would end and there would be a border of sometimes where entirely different species would exist within, you know, a mile of each other on either side. But he really, you know, in the course of his life, he realized the importance that these birds, these specimens that he collected, were like the individual letters that make up the volume of the Earth's deep history. And he really implored the British government to protect these things against all odds for future generations of researchers, because who knew what answers these birds might hold.
Yeah.
And that's really why over the past century, these birds were protected against German Zeppelins in the First World War. They were secreted out of London after Hitler's Luftwaffe hit the Natural History Museum 28 times. It's just no one could have imagined where the ultimate threat would come in the form of a 20-year-old American flautist who was a Victorian salmon fly tire on the side.
And he has a rock in a suitcase. Well, he has a glass cutter, but he drops it. And so he breaks through the window of where these are stored, where the specimens that were collected by Wallace and others. And he has become obsessed with, you know, they're expensive to get these feathers. Many of them are illegal to trade in. And he commits a really kind of smash and grab job. It takes the museum a good month to realize what has gone wrong. How come?
The British Museum has something like 750,000 bird skins. And so kind of in a sad echo of the whole Darwin Wallace thing, when they found broken glass the morning after the theft, they raced over to Darwin's birds to make sure that no one had stolen anything from Darwin's collection. They didn't, no one looked to make sure Wallace's birds were still there.
Right.
So in a collection of this size, I mean, we're talking about 1,500 large cabinets, each of which have dozens of drawers, which have, you know, hundreds of thousands of species. So it's forgivable that they might not have noticed right away because it's of the size of it. What becomes a little frustrating is that even though Edwin left a pretty glaring digital trail, it was 15 months before he was discovered and arrested, over which time he had already plucked and sold and dismembered the majority of these birds that he had stolen that night.
And he clips those biodata tags off as well to cover the fact of where they came from. So time is of the essence, but they're not successful in that regard. And then as you follow throughout the book, the justice here, it becomes sort of an interesting case. Is it interesting or difficult to prosecute because of what was stolen? And it's hard to put there's a financial price tag on these because of how much he's able to sell them for, but how do you articulate what really has been lost in this theft?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the tricky things that museums struggle with all the time. They even talk about, you know, how do you do insurance on something that has no imaginable value? I mean, the value is staggering to science, but, you know, they didn't know the black market that existed at the time and that a single one of these birds would sell for thousands and thousands of dollars. But the director of the museum in the courtroom said that this was a catastrophic theft from humanity, that we have employed these birds in study after study after study over generations. I mean, we understand the impact of DDT pesticides by studying these collections because we could definitively show that eggshells had gotten thinner after it was introduced. We now know from a study of over a century of seabirds that mercury levels are rising, and that shapes not just, you know, that doesn't just affect fish and birds, it affects humans that feed on that. It affects the whole food chain. He has, in stealing these birds, blown open a hole in the scientific record that unless they could be found, was catastrophic. And
right.
And by the time I heard about this story, frankly, nobody was looking for them. It was a closed case. He managed to avoid spending a single night in prison because of what I contend is a spurious diagnosis of Asperger's, which he essentially admitted to me in the interview, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said that he became what he needed to become at that moment while he was meeting with the psychologist. But yeah,
who happens to be Sacha Baron Cohen's cousin, right? So you can't make this up when you're following this trail. It's such an intriguing story. And to be clear for listeners, these people who tie the flies don't fish. This is an art form. This is a Victorian. It's an obsession. It's about status. About which feathers you can get. And when you sort of start approaching them as you end up at a conference, sort of, you know, spontaneously in some ways and start asking questions, they actually kind of vaguely menacing toward you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the context here is that in my previous life, I was in charge of the reconstruction of Fallujah in Iraq for the U.S. government.
Right.
And just suffice it to say, I've lived through some unpleasant moments in life, and I showed up at the International Fly Tying Symposium in Somerset, New Jersey, at the DoubleTree Hotel, where you picture a huge conference hall full of I'm sorry to say, it's just a fact. Mostly overweight men hunched over these vices, tying brightly colored feathers around the hooks. And I went around the room asking these guys, you know, like, because a lot of them were selling feathers. I asked if they had any of the rare birds that I knew were missing from the museum. And a lot of them were trying to sell me feathers. I don't know if they were from Edwin's stash or if they were from another source. But at random, I just, after one guy tried to sell me some of these things, I told him, you know, I'm thinking about writing something about the Tring heist and the feather thief. And he looked up at me and he said, I don't think you're going to write that story. And I said, no, why? And he goes, because we're a small, tight-knit community, and you do not want to mess with us. And, I mean, in all honesty, I was thrilled. Like, my heart started racing. I was so excited to get a threat from a guy with some, you know, colorful feathers pinched in between his fingers seemed like progress to me after right. what I had previously lived through. But it also just alerted me to the fact that this is just a, I mean, like you said, this is so weird that no one could make this up. And the more I started digging around, the crazier it got.
Right. Because you're not satisfied. Everyone else seems to be satisfied. The scientists, in this case, the curators of the museum, they feel slightly defeated. They know that there's no scientific value to recovering anything else. Law enforcement has done a fine job, but they don't necessarily have time anymore. What made you say, not only am I going to write a book about what happened, but I'm going to relentlessly try to find out what is still out there and whether or not I can convince people who haven't already sent their specimens or their feathers back to the museum that I can find some more and maybe even find out if there was an accomplice in this case?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first started out, I honestly just thought this would be a quirky little fun side story. Maybe I could write it up as a magazine piece. I mean, at the time that I found about this, I had never written a book. I hadn't written a magazine piece before. It was something kind of shiny to me. But then, you know, at some point, the balance tipped from the quirkiness to the seriousness when I realized how much of a legacy of the sort of forward march of human knowledge and understanding was bound up in these skins. And also, you know, to be totally blunt, a really kind of pissed off sense that justice had been denied here. And I'd go on these forums and I'd see these things being trafficked. You can go on eBay today and search for resplendent quetzal feathers, which is an endangered species, and you can buy a pair for $100.
Right.
And I felt that there was this whole marketplace going on around this stuff, and in some cases the guys in the forums would joke and they'd post a picture of a different museum and they would say paging secret agent Edwin Rist, and they would you know, go break into this one for us. And I think there was some kind of just innate sense that something rotten had happened here and no one was trying to solve it anymore. And I thought, well, why don't I just see what I can find out. But I didn't know what I was doing at the beginning. I just was just making a huge timeline and making a sort of map of what I jokingly call the feather underground. And as soon as I started digging around, things started getting deleted from the forums. And I mean, they did their best to resist the story getting right. out, but I found it.
And it takes me back, and I wonder, you know, you're looking at Alfred Wallace's notebooks, and you tell this story of him sort of, he's the first, you know, first European, the first naturalist to view the bird of paradise's mating ritual in the wild. And you're in his head a little bit there, and I don't know if that came from the notebooks or just that he has a realization that that not everything in nature is for, you know, to be plucked apart and used in these different ways. And some of these people that you're investigating don't quite get that either. They feel like this is just, it's for them.
That's right.
It felt like there was a connection there, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, Wallace was really just amazingly prescient in what he wrote. I mean, he described these, if your listeners have never seen a bird of paradise mating dance. They should just go on YouTube, and the rest of the day will be shot, because these are right. These are otherworldly creatures that have evolved into such gorgeous things. And Wallace recognized it as he was staring at one of these birds, that their beauty was so captivating that if civilized man, which he kind of tongue-in-cheek referred to them, if civilized man ever discovered these things, he would want them and desire them so badly that he would lead to their extinction. And that's almost exactly what happened. I mean, this story is kind of there's a sort of cloud hanging over the whole story, which is the pursuit of these birds for women's fashion in the 19th century was what was historians have called the single largest direct extermination of wildlife in the history of the planet. This was like a luxury good in the day. Wallace saw the future playing out just shortly before it actually happened.
The book is called The Feather Thief. My guest, Kirk Wallace Johnson, shedding light on what is still going on in this area. Kirk, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and the book.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.